The following program contains mature language and potential spoilers. Listeners be advised.
Welcome to the Marvel Superheroes Podcast. I'm Diablo Frank, and with me is...
Illegal Machine.
And no Mr. Fix-It, because his audio sucks, and we're doing this over the interwebs.
Yes, good old interwebs.
Today we're going to be covering a story about the Lady Demon. I think that's how you pronounce it. Does that A actually get pronounced on these things?
I was, in my brain, pronouncing it with the A.
Jim Lee, I think, probably stole this... I guess it's... Is it Celtic? What do you call the Scots? Ancient Scots stuff?
We can do Celtic.
Okay, we'll go with Celtic, even though that's probably offensive to our Scottish listeners. Hi, Martin. But yeah, he had the demonites that were a big part of his Wildstorm mythology. I guarantee you he read this story back in the early 80s, and he probably swiped this weird spelling from this story.
I will agree without any reason to back that up. Okay. It sounds good, though.
I wanted to do something simple. I've got a copy of Bizarre Adventures number 25. This is technically the first issue of Bizarre Adventures because it had previously been Marvel Preview Magazine that changed titles with this issue, the Lethal Ladies edition. I'd picked up some Marvel Ages over the weekend, and Ralph Macchio was talking about having written a story for Bizarre Adventures featuring Black Widow drawn by Paul Galassi. And I was like, I think I have that book. And I went upstairs, I went through my magazine, and sure enough, I did. But we'll save the Black Widow one for another time. And I figured, let's get some use out of this Lady Demon and then clear out some mail.
Okay, cool. Let's do it.
Especially because of the pedigree of the creators. We've got Chris Claremont on writing, Michael Golden on art, and Terry Austin as the inker.
Golden-Austin combo.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. These are the same guys who created Rogue.
Really?
You knew that Michael Golden and Claremont created Rogue, right? For the Avengers annual?
But Rogue's first appearance was in an Avengers annual, right?
Yeah.
So did they do the story? I think I have that annual.
Yeah, they did that story.
Oh, interesting. I don't know. Why am I surprised that Chris Claremont, Michael Golden, and Terry Austin did a Avengers annual? Should I be surprised by that? To me, they're X-Men people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think Michael Golden at this point in time, he'd probably already done Micronauts, and that was his biggest claim to fame to this point. Shag could probably chime in, but I don't think any of us have ever read any Micronauts stuff of substance.
No, I have never even... I probably haven't even touched a Micronauts comic book ever in my life. Even like accidentally.
Probably sorting out some 20-cent bins or something.
No way.
Certainly not any Michael Golden issues, though.
No, I highly doubt it.
Maybe some of the later stuff with Broderick or Kelly Jones, one of those.
You're naming things I don't know.
You know what a Kelly Jones is.
Well, I do, but I don't know them all associated with the Micronauts. Let's move on rapidly.
What the hell's the deal with Lady Demon?
What is the deal with Lady Demon? A question we all ask before reading this comic book. The first panel of the first page has the Hindenburg exploding with the words, "by virtue of blood."
And it's not a drawing of the Hindenburg, it's an actual photograph. And this won't be the last time that happens.
Correct, which is an interesting thing they thread throughout the issue. They mix art with photos. It's very interesting. From the first panel, you're already set up in what I call the Titanic paradox. You know how this is going to end.
Well, you're not going to show a blown up Hindenburg unless you're going to blow up the Hindenburg at the end of the story.
Right. The movie Titanic, we all knew how Titanic was going to end. The boat always sinks, folks. Even though you're going to go in and watch. Well, I think Titanic was, 9 hours long?
I've never seen it, but where I work, I think it's on every single day. And it seems to play throughout the entire day when I'd pass by and see a TV screen going.
Well, it's possible it's just one long director's cut version that lasts 3 to 4 weeks long. So the entire movie is long, but you know where it's going to end with the boat sinking. So that's what I call the Titanic paradox. You know, you're not supposed to know the ending of the movie, but because the movie is about or revolves around a historical event, you know how it's going to end.
Well, I think that that's actually part of the paradox, though, is that because you know how it's going to end, it's going to color your perceptions of everything leading up to that inevitability.
Correct. That's where we start with Lady Damon, the Hindenburg exploding. So that's the first panel. From there, we start kind of going into her quote-unquote origin.
I am Megan Demon, and the new century is 10 years old. I am 6. Our home stands in the remote fastness of the Sutherland Highlands in northern Scotland, a wild place where families who can trace their lineage back for 1,000 years are still considered young. Clandemon is old. So these two sisters are growing up in this estate, and they're segregated from pretty much everybody else, and it's not exactly a heavily populated area anyway. Megan was born during the summer solstice, so she's the child of light. Her older sister, Elizabeth, who I believe is 4 years older than her, is basically her only companion. And her father has no nickname for her. She was born during the winter solstice. She's the dark one. And so the first time she has her menses, the two girls go off and have underage full frontal nudity scene in a Marvel comic book where they perform some sort of satanic rite. And the next morning, their mother's mutilated corpse is found out in the countryside. 4 years later, when Megan finally has her first bleed, the older sister talks her into doing another one of these deals, and then the father dies. Elizabeth goes off and pursues dark magic, leaving her sister to try to figure out what the hell she's going to do with the rest of her life.
That's a very good synopsis of this, including the reference to the full frontal satanic rituals, which was a little shocking this far into the book.
Right. I mean, did you even assume that this was a Marvel book when I sent you the link to see the artwork?
No. I thought this was, I don't know what this was.
This was definitely an artifact leftover from the 70s when that kind of shit was cool.
Yeah, it reminded me very much of the Tigra story we read.
Yeah, everybody was all like mystic crystal revelations. So that kind of thing was pretty hip at the time and before the old American response to sexuality and nudity flared up again.
Yeah, and actually it's a very good point about the dark crystal mysticism stuff because on the next page, Megan is sent a deck of tarot cards. And I'm like, yes, tarot cards. Now all we need is a Ouija board.
Yeah, but instead we get a quartz cat skull necklace, which is apparently a ward of protection for the younger sister as she's left alone at the estate.
And not any set of tarot cards. These are custom. At this point, she hasn't seen, is it Alyssa or Elizabeth? Elizabeth.
It's another one of these spellings, this slightly foreign version of a spelling. It's spelled with an A, but I'm still saying it's Elizabeth. It sounds phonetically about the same. It's probably just some sort of old Scottish version of the name that we're all familiar with.
I'm down with that. So Elizabeth, she's gone. She rolls out. Both the parents are dead. Megan is sort of just in charge of the estate now.
Well, at one point, the sister does come back, doesn't have anything to do with Megan, and she instead meets with the tribal elders, because we still have tribes in Scotland, and they didn't give her whatever it was that she wanted, so she leaves, and then they all got up and killed themselves the next day. The only thing that was left was a letter of abdication, making Megan the sole ward of the estate, and therefore she is the Lady Demon.
Elizabeth vanishes back into obscurity, and nobody knows where she is. At that point, we're introduced to our good friend, Ian McInnes. Is that right? Did I pronounce that correctly? Ian McInnes, M-A-C-I-N-N-I-S.
I don't know. He looks like Banshee from the X-Men to me, but I guess he's the wrong nationality.
He looks exactly like Banshee from the X-Men, dude. That is fantastic.
What they said in the text was that the Great Depression has hit and the entire world is succumbing to it. And one of the only places where they still prosper is on the estate of the demons. Because they can do well even in these adverse times, despite them having a bad reputation being, you know, known as demons and all. She has all these suitors who come and try to hook up with her, and this guy hung around as a friend instead of trying to milk that cow.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I can see that. So he's just kind of trying to, I don't know, she's in sort of like a bit of a depression, right? Because she's always sort of had this weird mental link to her sister, right? She's basically obsessed.
She's fixated because she's got drawn into this sorcery that resulted in the death of their parents. She's scared to death of her sister, and yet she's also infatuated by that power, that connection to something greater. So she's at war with herself over whether to combat her sister or join her, but she's definitely looking into what she can do with the magic, whichever way she decides to go, and she's obsessed with it. Ian's aware of this and warns her off of it, tries to get her to chill out for a little while.
Right, because all she does is she just spends all of her time in the library that they have there, going through all these books and reading their history and all this stuff, and it being infatuated with her sister. So finally he's like, look, let's just get out of the house for a while. We'll drive out to London. We'll check some stuff out. You know, it's all going to be awesome. And that's when she's jacking around with the tarot cards, and she's like, you know, it's so weird. This tarot card deck, I've had it forever. It's custom made for me. But I don't remember there being two death cards.
And that's one of those deals, too, where you can tell that somebody found out about tarot cards from a horror movie or something. Yeah. Because death in tarot doesn't actually mean death. I think it's supposed to mean a dramatic change. So having two death cards wouldn't mean anything except for a whole lot of dramatic change.
Right. But obviously for the purposes of the book, now he has entered her life, and now instead of only having one death card, now there's two death cards. Some foreshadowing there.
I'm guessing. Well, I think he'd been around for a little bit. I don't think he's entering her life at that point. I think he's been around for a bit. But the sister's re-entering the life all of a sudden.
Right. But, well, I mean, as soon as he's finally getting her to, you know, obviously, if she agrees to now leave her library that she's basically chained herself to, and he's trying to be like, hey, forget the sister. To me, there's a connection starting to grow there. And immediately upon that, there's a second death card in the deck.
Oh, sure. It's a tarot tugging of the leash.
Right, or bashing over the head with a baseball bat. It's not the most subtle of foreshadowing I've seen in a comic book.
Well, speaking of unsubtle violence, then we go to the next page.
Yeah, we go to the next page, and I guess their travels have drawn them to Stonehenge, and they just sort of saunter into Stonehenge.
And as someone who's been to Stonehenge, you don't just sort of happen to get there. That's a long-ass bus ride, let me tell you. And there's nothing out there in Salisbury's plain. There's no other reason to be out that away.
The text sort of lets you know that they don't know why they're going to Stonehenge. Like, something's just drawing them to Stonehenge. Except Megan knows this is Elizabeth. They're doing these things. They can't not do these things. They can't not go to Stonehenge. But they're there, even though they know they shouldn't be there. But she just knows it's because Alyssa is bringing them there at this exact moment.
Seems like virtually anything that ever happens in her life involves this person. It's whenever she tries to do anything, go anywhere, she's sucked back into this dark magic.
So this page, and this is another, like we were saying, it's actually a photograph of Stonehenge. Two of them, one where they kind of show Stonehenge, and the two panels down, it's got Stonehenge, the middle of Stonehenge, as Ian and Megan are sort of walking upon this ceremony.
Yeah, ritual human sacrifice involving full frontal female nudity again.
Right, as Elizabeth has carved the heart of this woman out and is holding it in the air with one hand and this dagger in the other hand.
That is the thickest, gooeyest blood I've ever seen anywhere.
Yeah, for real.
She bleeds caramel, and it looks tasty in black and white.
Hey, you know what? It kind of does. Because the detail on the heart isn't anything, you know, that could just be a hunk of brisket for all we know. We don't know. And that could be barbecue sauce. What they've done is, since they've taken the photo of Stonehenge, they've actually drawn the figures onto the photo. So, I mean, I've seen this done before in 70s comic books. Obviously, there was no, they couldn't just shop it. I don't know. Is this good, or is this a shortcut? Are we going to talk about this later?
Yeah, we can take a moment, I think. I don't know. I want to dwell on it too terribly much. I think that Jack Kirby, to a large degree, pioneered this in the comics. And with Kirby, it worked, because what he was usually doing is creating a dissonance between his comic book illustration and a reality. But usually he used it to enhance the surreality of a situation. Like in a New Gods cover, you're getting the sense of Orion flying not just through the abyss of space, but he's traversing dimensions, because there's actual dimension to the artwork, because he actually seems more three-dimensional than the piece of artwork that he's been superimposed upon. And so it kind of screws with your head. It works in that respect. Where here, I don't think it works, in part because they just need better contrast. All the photos are very light gray, and then the illustrations are much darker, richer inks. And that's a major issue. But also, there's some issue with integrating his very cartoony, very detailed art style onto photographs that didn't impact Kirby. It's unsettling, not in the sense of the way Kirby used it, but in the sense of it being amateurish looking, ultimately.
Right, and for me, Stonehenge is a very important historical landmark, but the other side of it, it's not anything that's remotely detailed.
I'd much rather see Terry Austin ink all those rocks like he did when Byrne would do all those type of rocks. That's right, what I want to see.
Just draw Stonehenge, bro. It's not like it's... I understand them doing cityscapes, or even, I mean... To one extent, like I said, that first panel was the exploding Hindenburg, which I guess, those images are kind of played out. I don't know if they were as played out back when this comic book was made.
There was a lot of Hindenburg stuff even back in the early 80s. Yeah, I think it was actually probably played out even by then.
It had to be, because it was the cover of Led Zeppelin's first album. Like, everybody's seen that image a billion times. So I kind of would have liked to have seen them draw that too. But at least I get that, because that's an extremely detailed, busy photograph. And they're trying to set you in the time that it took place. Whereas Stonehenge looks like Stonehenge, no matter if you looked at it 1,000 years ago or today. It all looks
well, and the composition and the lighting does kind of that 70s vibe to it. I'm hearing Leonard Nimoy as I'm looking at this stuff, because it looks like that very 70s In Search of quality to it.
I guess what I'm trying to say is, not feeling it.
Agreed.
She cuts this chick's heart out. So at this point, Megan is sort of, she's torn. She's like, do I run over there to stop this? Or am I running over there to join in?
Pretty sure once the heart's in somebody's hands, you could count her out.
Right. Yeah. No.
You know, I think the sacrifice is a little beyond saving by that point.
I don't think it's to save the chick's life. I think it's to stop the ritual. But fair enough. She says she's feeling helpless because Ian is trying to hold her back. But then she's like, no, I got to go to her. But why am I running to her? Am I running to her to stop or interfere? Or am I running to her because I am supposed to join in You know what I mean?
Like, something that there's a lot of in this story, especially since it's captioned, so you're getting a lot of internal monologue, is this character's ambivalence. She's horrified by the darkness of the acts, and at the same time, she's seduced by the promise of power and new horizons. And I want to comment, though, on this three-panel progression that we have, where you see Elizabeth, and she's holding a bloody knife, and in the background, this tentacled Lovecraftian creature begins to appear. Then in the second panel, you see a bit more of it, and then in the third panel, it recedes, and her background goes completely black, so they can put more text behind her and have her drop in some dialogue. It's all the same illustration. It's just that there are elements that are introduced to the illustration progressively or taken from it. The contrasts are played with. This is another instance where I think that you've got a lot of experimentation with the story, where the story exists more to experiment artistically than it does existing to actually get involved in the story of Lady Demon. Because it, you know, what kind of tricks can we do? Can I use the same people artwork with these little tweaks and have it work and have it function? There's so much of that in this story that I have to think that that's one of the main goals of the story, is just to give them a vehicle by which to experiment.
I can see that for sure. Because they play around with some of the panel boxes too. The first few pages, there are no hard borders around the panels. The panels are sort of floating, and the text will actually break the panel, bleed out into the edge. It's some interesting layouts for sure.
Yeah, then there's a lot of gray tones, which you don't associate with Michael Golden. And sometimes it's unfortunate because there's so much inky residue that you'd lose some of the detail. But those characters really pop against these more soft focus background elements.
Yeah, and this is a dark story, but they certainly, the mood of the artwork, even again, sometimes mixing the bad photographs and stuff, although that doesn't work, I think the mood of the artwork fits the storytelling very well.
With the exception that Michael Gold is such a bright artist, such a beautiful and sweet, there's a sweetness to his work. So there's a dichotomy because all this dark stuff that's happening doesn't suit his ability to convey that story very well, I don't think.
Really? Okay.
I think the art is pretty, but I don't feel the darkness because I'm too busy looking at the line work and the intricacy of it, that energy that Terry Austin imbues onto Golden's work.
See, because I disagree, because I think Elizabeth is super dark, but I think Megan is not on purpose.
Maybe. It just gets me, though, because it's so light looking, it's so cartoony, that I can't buy into the horror aspects. It's too inherently light for me to get sucked into it the way like a Gene Colan could.
Well, yeah. Well, and I'm not saying that he's Bernie Wrightson. I'm just saying that to me, I thought it worked. Anyway, we'll keep going.
Okay. So we see that shot of the Hindenburg, which, if I didn't know better, looked like bad CGI.
it may have been.
Is that like a model, or is that an actual photograph? Did the Hindenburg look that fake naturally?
So here's the deal. Didn't you and I go, there was an exhibit at the Museum of Fine Arts Houston that detailed photography tricks and post-processing tricks before Photoshop. Like the whole, did you and I go see that one?
Yeah, we saw that together.
This could easily have been one of those photographs, for all we know, where they sort of superimposed a normal picture of the Hindenburg onto a cityscape.
Yeah, because it's so high up in the air, too. It's almost like, how could you shoot the Hindenburg as clearly as you did up that high in the air? What were you using to get there?
Yeah, and obviously the Hindenburg itself is super crisp and sharp.
Yeah, I suspect there's some chicanery at work here.
Yeah, so even though this photo was taken quite a long time ago, there were still processes that could doctor photos. So I think that it may not just be your eyes playing tricks on you. This could very well be olden-timed Photoshop. It jumps straight from Stonehenge to the Hindenburg, and they're on the Hindenburg.
And they've lost 2 weeks of their lives. They've got their passports, everything's in line, except they have no recollection of the previous 2 weeks.
Right. So at first I was like, well, okay, so they're really, I know this is only a 14-page comic book. So I'm like, man, they're really sort of pushing through this. But she actually says to herself, the explanation of our presence on the Hindenburg explained 2 weeks vanished from our lives. Drugs? Hypnotism? Ian, you saw what happened at Stonehenge, even if you refuse to believe it. So they completely acknowledge that we jumped straight from Stonehenge to the Hindenburg, and nobody knows why.
Yeah, right? if there's an issue with the narrative flow, it's addressed, no prized, within the text itself.
Correct.
But what isn't addressed is how bad this next panel looks, where they're trying to sit in a photograph from the Hindenburg, and it's completely not working at all.
This is one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. So it's a photo of like a galley or a dining area on the Hindenburg, and they're trying to, what it looks like they did was he drew two characters sitting in chairs, cut them out, taped them onto the photo, and then photocopied it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Neglecting that there's a big metal bar that should be cutting across them that isn't, and that they're sort of floating, and there's no way Ian is even remotely in his chair, and I don't know what he's doing with his hands because it's not touching the armrest.
Right. It's like he's supposed to be sitting himself down into a chair.
But it looks like he's copying a squat over the chair.
It looks like he's sliding down the arm rail is what it looks
right.
like.
Yeah, and then because they're obviously foregrounded, then there are other characters that are better integrated into that environment. Ratios aren't correct. Their proportions aren't correct. They look like little people.
And that one's not bad because he's like holding on to the arm rail and that's done correctly.
Mm-hmm.
This other panel the two figures we're supposed to actually be focusing on is a complete disaster, but hey, props, it's so bad I kind of like it. In the scuffle at Stonehenge, Ian saying, no, I got hit in the head, I got concussed, I don't really know what's going on, but it's not magic, I don't believe in magic, forget all that stuff, even though he witnessed human sacrifice with a bizarre, as you say, Lovecraftian animal appearing from a portal behind, whatever. This dude is in serious denial right now. So she starts flipping through her tarot cards again and, of course, flips to the death card. And she's just like, this was another little disconnect between the art and the writing because she looks extremely surprised on her face. But then she's saying to herself, the second death card, I shouldn't be surprised. But she's in extreme shock in the panel. So it's
The dialogue is like mildly indignant.
Yeah, whereas I think she's flipping through the cards knowing exactly what's about to happen.
Well, and there's another one, too, where he's statting in the same image twice, and he's using gray tones to cover up for the fact that you're looking at the same picture twice, essentially.
Yeah, of the cards flipping on the table. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, it's used three times from the looks of it, because on the next page, they do a close-up crop of it.
Yeah, you're right. So he's still saying, like, I don't give a crap about your cards. They don't mean anything. And then out of nowhere, who appears? Our good friend Elizabeth, floating in the room. And then who promptly levitates Ian out of his chair. So, of course, at that point...
Well, no, she elevates Megan right. out of the chair, and Ian's still left to watch. That's probably the best instance of them integrating art into a photograph, because it actually looks cool with them floating. They're passing immaterially through the hull. So it works here because they're not supposed to be interacting very well with the environment.
Yeah, that one, you're right. That one does work because at first glance, you don't immediately realize that that's a photograph that they're floating in.
Yeah, and the contrast works too. The gray tones make it where everything integrates fairly well with one another.
Yeah, yes, I would agree with you. This probably works better than any of the other ones.
Like the very next one.
Yeah. Well, and even they cut to Ian in the next panel, like surprised because Megan and Elizabeth have vanished from the room. And in the background is a photograph of a bunch of people standing looking out the windows of the Hindenburg, like they're looking down out at the ground.
Right, these fuzzy, old-timey-looking people whereas he's wearing this sweater that has more detail than most pages of Don Heck artwork.
Yeah, he's basically saying, nobody else saw this. Everybody's just standing around like there's nothing going on. So, again, you can see what he's trying to do. I'm just not sure if it worked.
Yeah, Claremont's doing a pretty good job of trying to cover for the stuff that doesn't quite fit.
Yeah, so the entire next page is basically photographs.
Again, though, that Hindenburg can't be real. I don't know what the hell that is. It so looks like bad early 90s CGI. Yeah, I don't really know what that actually is, but that's exactly what it looks like.
Strange. Again, I respect the effort, though.
I do. I agree. Yeah. There isn't a lot of venues anymore for you to experiment in this way and get it published, I mean. You can play around with this stuff and then throw it up on your DeviantArt account. But back in the day, if you wanted to experiment and you wanted to actually continue to eat the month you're doing those experimentations, you had to find a way of working it into your commercial work.
Yeah. So basically, we've cut back to Megan and Elizabeth. They're into the inner construct of the Hindenburg. So we have all like the trusses and catwalk and everything all around them.
I don't know if a blimp has rafters, but that's what I'm kind of seeing.
Right. It's sort of the inner skeleton of the balloon of the Zeppelin itself. You can see where this is going. Oh, and we should say that Ian remembers that even though they got shook down by Elizabeth's people, that they missed his pistol that was in one of his bags. So he goes to grab the pistol, more foreshadowing. Megan at this point is being explained to by Elizabeth that, look, we have joined powers. It takes two of us to do this stuff.
Our powers are linked. We're going to open a gate to the dark dimension. You're with me or you're against me. And she brings up another weird jacked up Lovecraftian monster who's pretty cool looking.
Yeah, he's pretty cool looking.
Skeletal winged thingy-majig with a crocodile head and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, referred to as the emissary. So she's like, look, I've got this one emissary. He himself could destroy an entire nation or an army. Think of you and I together, opened the portal together, how powerful we could be if we opened the gate, as they call it.
Yeah, or what she was saying is at Stonehenge, they unlocked the gate, but they haven't actually opened it yet with what they're going to do with the Hindenburg. But this is another one where you've got the trickery because you've got three panels that are the exact same or largely the same panel. One of them has a photograph, and then they throw a little gray tone, and they start building the demon, half the demon, and then the final panel is the whole of the demon. So it's supposed to be a progression, but really it's one photograph and one finished image to create three panels.
Yep.
And then on the very next page, you have you have five panels, which consist of two panels worth of artwork, essentially, because it's Megan reacting over and over again in shock and horror, and Elizabeth conversing with the emissary and making her final sales pitch.
The first panel is surprised Megan, and you see a shadowy figure approaching behind her, which is Ian running with the pistol. And then you cut to Elizabeth, and she's got the emissary who's facing away from Megan, and then you cut back to Megan, and Ian is closer, and he's like, God! And when he says God, they cut back to Elizabeth, and this time the demon who was looking away has now turned and is looking at them, which I think is a badass panel. I like what he did. I know it's totally shortcut, because like you said, this is two panels.
Yeah, but it's done cinematically, and they're using a gray tone to steadily make it lighter to darker, so the intensity of it is there. And also, when the gun finally flares, when Ian fires, you got this burst of white in the midst of a lot of darkness around that particular panel.
I like that. I like when he says, God, and the demon's face turns, and it's all jacked up, and like you said, crocodilian.
Yeah, and all this salivation coming from its fangs.
The final panel is Ian pointing the pistol, and she's like, don't! And the dude just empties the gun to the demon. None of it hits the demon. It goes, passes through the emissary and hits Elizabeth. And the entire time, you're hearing Megan's inner monologue, and he rushes up behind me, exactly as she planned. And I'm here out on the thing, exactly how she planned. He found the pistol in his bag, just as Elizabeth had planned. You know what I mean? Like, she has set all this stuff up.
It's all inevitability. Regardless of Elizabeth getting shot, that's what she wanted in this circumstance.
Exactly.
Because what the main thing is, everybody's in place, all the emotions are high, and the emissary is communing with Megan's soul. It's that final attempt to turn her to the dark side of the Force.
Elizabeth dead. She says, okay, I'll just read this panel. I had never felt, never conceived of such absolute sensations, agony, ecstasy, desolation, triumph. The more I experienced, the more I desired. I tasted godhood. Again, this conflict inside of her, as much as she wants to reject this dark magic demon, daemon, dermon past of hers, of her clan, at the same time, she gets off on these things whenever it's around her. So it's this dichotomy, I guess is the cheesy word to use. And then she says, as this emissary is touching her soul, she can feel all of the other emissaries and masters on the other side of this gate around her. So she knows all she needs, that since she's the other half of the puzzle, all she has to do is think about it and she can open this door. But she keeps fighting it off and fighting it off and fighting it off.
Let's see what she said. But they and Elizabeth, who thought she'd allowed for every eventuality, reckoned without my Scott's stubbornness and my lifelong desire to be free. I would be Elizabeth's puppet no more. I fought with a will to survive that matched Elizabeth's will to destroy, and I prevailed. And the demon goes up in smoke just as the Hindenburg itself is beginning to.
It's funny because Ian the whole time is like, we got to get out of here. Hurry up or we're going to die. And I'm thinking to myself, where are you going to go, Ian?
You're at the epicenter of an explosion in the midst of hydrogen gas. You guys should be dead.
Well, and even then, you're going to go down into the, like, where are you going to go? Like, did you have
I don't think anybody successfully jumped off the Hindenburg.
No.
And people tried. That's the whole Oh, the Humanity. Part of that is you're watching people jumping off the Hindenburg before it lights up, and they don't have anywhere to land.
Again, they do the copy panel. So she's getting one last glimpse of Elizabeth's dead body as her eyes are closed and the panels are all lighting up with fire. And then the next panel, the body has opened its eyes and she's just saying, poor simple sister, we are bound. Then the next panel, she like bursts into flames and she got these creepy looking eyes staring at her, but now it's just like burning flesh and skull teeth and stuff.
The last panel is a metal album cover from the 1980s.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. So then the last page, page 39, is the three progressing panels of the Hindenburg exploding. And these are, of course, photos. The Hindenburg exploding and crashing to the ground where she survives, right?
That's what they say in the text, yeah, even though you don't actually see her or anybody else.
Yeah, and all she can, she's talking about how her body's burned, or all she smells is burning flesh and clothes. Where she says, "I still hear the screams, smell the stench of burning fabric and flesh, my clothes, my body." So, and then she says, "Worst of all, I remember Elizabeth's dreams and how close they came to fruition. I live to wonder, ellipsis. And in the darkness, which it never leaves me to fear if the battle's truly over. I escaped with my life, but have I truly won?" So she's the survivor of the Hindenburg disaster.
Right, that's exactly. Cool. And also she's now truly, not just by decree, but by experience, Lady Demon. And you have that empty promise of more adventure, more terrors to await. This character never appeared anywhere else ever again.
Yeah, I sort of had a feeling that's where it was going. They foreshadowed that maybe Elizabeth didn't truly die because obviously Lady Demon survived, so Elizabeth could have survived too. So they foreshadow that they will meet again and she will prevail because she is Lady Demon or Damon.
My thinking is, in my own headcanon, I just want to pretend like she died in the Hindenburg since she never appeared anywhere else again. Since I'm pretty sure Marvel doesn't want to ever reprint this story, and if they did, they'd have to go in there and do some redrawing. It's jacked up no matter what you do, because the situation still involves two young girls killing their parents. So I think that this is probably one of those books, like a lot of times we go in and we look at a character and we're like, this character has so much potential, we need to get back to this character. Where in this circumstance, guess what? This is available online. It's got some pretty neat artwork. Definitely worth checking out. It's not a bad story, but I don't think we'd ever need to touch on these characters again. If Frozen had been a Lifetime movie instead, that's kind of what you end up with here.
Interesting. If Frozen was a Lifetime movie. Okay, I can kind of see that. I mean, well, you have to get rid of the nudity still, but this story was fine. I didn't think there was anything wrong with the story. It's a little cliched. The art was fascinating.
Yeah, and it's very much a product of the 70s, regardless of when it was actually published, which was, I believe, 81.
Okay, so this is 81. I was going to ask when this actually did come out. I wish, is Michael Golding on, Michael Golden on social media? We got to ask him about this comic book.
I'm not sure. You're welcome to give that a shot, though. Yeah, I know that he takes commissions and stuff, but I don't think he's actually on the Twitters or anything.
Like, bro, what were you thinking with this Lady Demon issue?
Yeah, and I did a little quick look to see if there was ever any interviews or anybody ever talked about this stuff, and it seems like there's just like this vacuum. You can find the actual story online. Nobody's ever going to reprint it. There's some blurbs for her at the various Marvel character Wikipedia-type sites, but she's basically a stub in Marvel history, regardless of the effort put into this first story.
There was way too much setup in this story to assume that it was supposed to be a one-shot, right? I mean, just discounting the end.
Well, I don't know. It kind of comes full circle, and I think maybe what we perceive now as setup might have just been something to engross you in the midst of the story, to make up for how much of the story is being told through captions instead of visually.
So at the beginning, since we're looking at, these are scans of a comic book, page one, I'm assuming this was supposed to be like the cover, or is this like the intro where it's actually got a character? It shows the full character design.
Oh, yeah. What it is here, I've got the magazine here. The actual cover is Paul Galassi, and it features all the female characters in the issue, which is Lady Demon, Black Widow, and the Daughters of the Dragon. And then when you open up to the inside front cover, it's a Galassi, Black Widow. And then the table of contents has the Lethal Ladies logo, the Lady Demon full figure image, and all the, you know, the indicia and stuff like that. And then the very next page is the start of the Black Widow story.
I dig the Lady Demon design.
Just neat to see someone from that era in comics, because since so much of comics started out right before World War II, there's a certain fashion sense and a certain iconography that we're used to, where this is a person who was born in, you know, 1904, I guess it was, if you do the math. So she's propelled through time, but this story ends before World War II, and so the fashion and the atmosphere is different. She's off in a Scottish keep somewhere. It's not the sort of thing you see in very many comics, even from the period that they're trying to represent.
Yeah, but she's got the big, like, sun hat. She's got the cat skull.
Yeah,
cool.
I can see where you're going there. I don't like the illustration very much, though, because where the work with Terry Austin as the inker in the story was very well realized, here it seems somewhat amateurish. The way the light hits and the way that the contours of the dress work, everything looks like it's made of plastic. It looks like a statuette being rendered in art as opposed to a human being.
Well, it looks like a character design. It looks like a official guide to the Marvel Universe panel.
Yeah,
right?
But maybe one of the ones from the later years or the very early ones, not the good stuff in the middle. Need Joe Rubenstein to go in there and do a run past it. My main issue here is you need a better inker. It probably was something that Golden inked himself, or it may not have even been drawn by Golden. It may just have his style, because it doesn't seem as well realized as his other work. It needs further embellishment. I can't forget that I'm looking at a drawing, is what I'm saying.
Oh, what this looks like to me is it was drawn and sent to Chris Claremont and say, hey, this is what I'm picturing. And he's like, okay, cool. And then finally they were like, hey, you guys have anything we can put in the table of contents? Yeah, sure. And he just threw some ink on it and sent it to him.
Yeah, I can see that.
From it, you get a sense of what her future outfit would be if this continued. So I think it looks pretty cool.
Well, that, and they went digging for stuff like this a few years back, trying to find all the characters that never made it into a Marvel Universe handbook, and they did repurpose this artwork for her entry.
Oh, did they really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, I haven't dug out my copy yet, but it's online.
That's crazy that she made an official handbook to the Marvel Universe. I haven't read tons of Chris Claremont. Was he this wordy?
Oh, yeah, he was always wordy. Well, this is a bit wordier than usual because of the nature of the story. It's appearing in a black and white magazine. There's a lot of stuff to fill in. But he was always very, very heavy on text.
Okay, I seem to
it's just that. Usually, he was usually contained in a dialogue balloon rather than those captions. But he could caption up some stuff, too.
Oh, word? He can caption his ass off. Let me go, Chris. Do you suggest anybody read this?
I think it's worthwhile to go check it out. I will have a link on the blog. You can go take a look for it for yourself. You can enjoy it or not as you find it. But I don't think this is a character you need to revisit. The trademark has already been taken by somebody else anyway in the years since. And it's a much more, you know, that's a character that actually has some degree of popularity. It's actually interesting because Lady Demon was, of course, just a variation on Lady Death. She had been possessed by a demonic force or some crap like that in a story arc. But because of the division of the Chaos Comics trademarks and copyrights, I believe that Dynamite Entertainment owns Lady Demon now, where Avatar's Boundless imprint does Lady Death. So you've actually separated what was one character into two. And essentially the venom of Lady Death is off at another company.
Weird.
It's very weird. I don't know how that works in a legal sense even. And in terms of her use in stories, which has happened, it screws with my head.
You're a Doctor Strange fan. Drawing magic is not easy, correct? How do you draw magic and make it any different from any other power?
Yeah, I think that one of the problems with magic is that you don't know, like if you see Iron Man shoot a repulsor blast at somebody, you have a sense of this being energy and force. You can apply the physics in your mind to it. You can fill in those gaps the way you would with anything else, you know, like an animated feature. Obviously, these are just drawings, but you have a sense of what it means for something to interact with something else on the screen. With magic, it's so ill-defined, and that's one of the things that a lot of people who hate magic stories are frustrated by, is you don't really know what this stuff does. There's a real-world counterpart to it, so you can't look at a photograph to reference it. Typically, when magic works best in comics, by my reckoning, it's when you have somebody like Steve Ditko who uses it as a license to go nuts and draw all kinds of weird, cool stuff. It doesn't matter what it does anymore because you're so involved in the phantasmagoria. It's all about this cool visual stuff going on in front of you. So when it's cosmic spooge being thrown out of the people's hands, that's when you've got bad magic.
I guess I would have liked to have seen a little more of that.
I didn't mind, though, because this story, obviously, its core is based in Lovecraft, and Lovecraft was all about hinting at stuff rather than detailing it at length. You're supposed to fill in that stuff with your own horrors, your own imaginings. It's supposed to be a trigger for your own mind to create things that disturb you specifically. So I think that they're trying to pull that off, but in a visual medium, it's more difficult because you're not just telling somebody something that's being manifest in their minds exclusively. You're showing them stuff. I do think that the Lovecraftian elements, the tentacles coming from the dark, that worked out fairly well, but the rare instances where they showed actual hand gestures and energy, that was shitty fire effects.
I totally get what you're saying, where they're trying to go a little more subtle, where you see the demon slowly emerge behind her. There's no cracking interdimensional orifice with demons clawing their way out. When she's in Stonehenge and after the sacrifice, it sort of slowly comes out behind her. And the whole reveal of the emissary is real low-key and so on, and I totally get that. And then when she's burning to death, and So sometimes I don't know how I feel.
This is where, again, my criticism of Michael Golden comes in, is he's really good at rendering stuff to look cool and energetic and lively and comic booky. And comic booky doesn't work for this type of story. It's the emissary is really well drawn, but you're not horrified of it because you're seeing every little detail on him. Everything's revealed, everything's well lit. So it becomes a man in a suit, even though it's a comic book. You see too much. There's too much visual information. So you can process it. You can go, okay, well, that's sort of like a crocodile creature. So I'm going to need this 10-point mace to kill that creature. In your mind, you fill in like, I can deal with this. I understand this. I can comprehend it. A lot of horror comes from the lack of comprehension. You don't know where the thing is. You don't know what it's planning to do to you. You don't know what horrors awaits you. It's that anticipation and that lack of knowledge.
I'm feeling that. I gotcha.
This week's Twitter follows Antonisa Scott, Charles C. Dowd, Christian Codicini, Dead Vinyl, Gash Films, Hero X at I Am Hero X, The Heroic Universe, John Henderson at All of Us Together, Mark at Your Mark One, Perturbed Renderings, Plastic Bank, and Ziggy at Mr. Jaffrey.
Our Twitter favorites come from AA88 Press.
It's Aces Adam and Eights.
Sorry?
Yeah, it's Aces and Eights. I don't know why they wrote it that way. When you actually go to their site, it just says Aces and Eights.
Well, you can't put eight. I mean, A and A would be Aces, eight, eight, eights. Got it. Very clever. Adam Blackmoon, Ange, Anthony Durso, Anti-Fascist, Baked English, Ben Cohen, Charles Washington, Charlton Hero, Chris Callahan, Chris Michael, Chris Thompson, CJ, Comic Nerds Unite, The Comic Syndicate, Count Druncula, David Golding Artist, Dead Vinyl, DS and RS, Eel Perrin, Ed Moore, Eternal Rage, Fantastiverse, Felicia, Future Primitive, The Irredeemable Shag, Josh George, Josias Arebalo? Man, I screwed that up. Cat McDonald, Kayla, Legion Bloggers, Longbox Graveyard, Lord Horse to Sizzle, his C's. Luke Dobb, hashtag Marvelous, Moldwitch, My Star Wars Story, Mystery Vlog, Oscar Olaldi, damn, Outside Longbox, Perfect Chaos, Phil Legg 22, Randy Caldwell, Randy Michael Smith, Retro Junkies. Retro Junkies, I lost my place. Run with Comics, Siskoid, Small Time, Storybreakers, Superboy, Sin, Tawala Sharp, Tim Van Outreve. Damn, I'm just screwing all these.
There's some tough ones this week.
Yeah, Top 5 Road Crew and Wetsuit. Hey, normally Top 5 Road Crew is the last one. Now we have Wetsuit right under the Top 5 Road Crew.
Oh man, I got you ripped. I didn't realize how few retweets there were comparatively. We got retweets from Ace and Aids Press, Adam Blackmoon, Ange, The Anti-Fascist, Baked English, Chris Thompson, Chris William, CJ, The Comic Syndicate, Count Druncula, Dead Vinyl, Eternal Rage, Fantastiverse, Felicia at Proxy, Firestorm Fan, Floatus Fan, Future Primitive, The Irredeemable Shag, Josias Arabello, Kayla at K-Monk, Keith G. Baker, hashtag Marvelous at DJ Dub Floyd, ManWithoutFear.com, My Star Wars Story, Mystery Vlog, Outside Longbox, Phil Leg 22, Randy Caldwell, Randy Micah Smith, Senate alias Scarecrow, Tawala Sharp at Tawala, Top 5 Road Crew, and the Ultraverse Network. So that's twice Top 5 got robbed of its last spot.
Should they be proud or not proud of that? I don't know.
It's at the alphabet. We can't fight the alphabet.
Yeah, hashtag the alphabet.
If you enjoy the Marvel Superheroes podcast, go to iTunes and check out Rolled Spine. You run a search for Rolled Spine. We got two other podcasts we're running these days. We've only got one installment of each one, but they're both freaking kick-ass, and they're better than most of our Marvel Superhero stuff. The Under Guys, the first edition, covers Image Comics and talks about the really boss ongoing series from Fantagraphics from the 90s called Minimum Wage, which was recently collected by Image Comics as Maximum Minimum Wage. It's a great podcast, and it's a really cool book. Go check that out. And also, we've started Rolled Spine, just called Rolled Spine, and it's us talking about everything that doesn't fit in one of our other podcasts. This last time we talked about a bunch of movies and a whole lot of music, and we were just very dismissive of a bunch of 90s grunge bands. So if you want to fight for the honor of Pearl Jam, then get on there, listen, and give us some comments.
Yeah, don't go all Jeremy on us. I don't know.
No, that was good. I like that. I should have seen it coming. I couldn't see it coming, though.
Well, at least I didn't do the... Go listen to those podcasts. They're sort of more of a door into what it's like to just be sitting around with the two of, or three of us.
If you really are friends, then you got to go listen to the good podcasts, not just the corporate shit that we do for no money.
Yeah. If you want to be one of our friends, go become one of our friends and see what it's like to just sit around and listen to us talk about random bullshit.
You want
to
be at the cool kids table, don't you?
And also, as Frank and I were just talking about, and this is a good way to end, if you're sitting around and you find yourself bitching about comic books all the time and how comic books suck and how back in your day comic books were good, maybe take a listen to the Underguides and you'll maybe open up a little doorway to some independent comic books that you hadn't read before. And maybe be like, you know what? Maybe I'll try this independent comic book out. It doesn't have Spider-Man in it or a Wolverine or a I don't know, insert, who's a DC character? It doesn't have a Green Lantern. Is he one of those guys?
Yeah, he's one of those guys.
It doesn't have a Green Lantern in it, but it talks about people's lives and stuff, and sometimes you can identify with.
And stuff of consequence actually happens, and change comes, and it actually is permanent and doesn't get reversed 6 months later because a bunch of fans bitched on Twitter.
Right, yeah. It's not a shitty comic book that's going to get canceled because it's shitty, and you get like a small segment of loud people on the internet to get it uncanceled. It's not like that. If you're wondering where all the good writers and stuff went that don't write your comic books anymore, they're making independent stuff, so maybe we may cover it, and you may find something you can go check out.
Yeah, we need to get another Underguides out. Toot sweet. because there's a lot of good stuff that we need to talk about.
Yes, 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 yes. So, yeah, go check those out.
Hey, have you read any of that stuff I gave you yet?
Fuck no.
Okay, well, read some of that shit so you can take part of the Under Guides. Otherwise, you're out of the podcast.
Okay. I'll read some.
Adam Black Moon included us on his hashtag Monday Madness, hashtag comics, hashtag Tuesday pods, hashtag oi, hashtag Fellow Friday, and hashtag Saturday Stalwarts. Hashtag rando. J. David Weeder also included us on a Follow Friday. And when we put out a new episode, Odell Abner Dracula said, hooray. Guanaman also offered cheers. Apologies for neglecting the other hosts in favor of a fellow Martianologist. Rest assured that you're all marvelous. I see what you did there.
Yeah, I see what you did there.
Jason Martinez let us know that he has listened to the excellent Alpha Flight Extravaganza and to Madame Natasha, the Mysterious Black Widow.
And we should say there that he's saying he's listening to the X-cellent. He wasn't calling the podcast itself excellent.
Yes, it wasn't actually a qualifier. It was a trademarkable call name.
Oh, man, but that's a total badass way to get trick-free press, is you just put great podcast at the beginning of every single one of the titles.
Right, you just call it the great podcast. It's like the band that called themselves Free Beer.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You just put that up on the marquee.
Keith G. Baker says, this is the only way I've heard of the Rime of the Ancient. God, man, what the fuck is this shit? Are we still talking about the Rime of the Ancient Mariner?
No, he included a video of, was it Iron Maiden who did that one? And also he referenced Doug McKenzie from SCTV.
Oh, that's Canadian.
A.
Oh, yeah, A. This next comment is fucking awesome. Do any of you listen to, or do you just like watch basketball and stuff? Basketball's awesome. So here in Houston, Texas, we have one of the more, I guess, out there GMs, general managers for the Houston Rockets, Daryl Morey. He's pioneered a lot of advanced metrics. He went to Northwestern. He hosts the Sloan Analytics Conference every year. He's sort of like a rock star among GMs, very controversial, but he's a huge comic book fan and has somehow played some sort of hypnosis on Rob Liefeld, who is a gigantic Los Angeles Lakers fan. And if you're a Los Angeles Lakers fan, you're almost definitely a Houston Rocket hater. 99% of my interaction with Rob Liefeld online has been arguing about basketball, because he is such an unabashed Kobe Bryant lover. It's the saddest thing, as Kobe Bryant has descended into a fucking bum, and watch all these guys try and defend him. Daryl Morey and Rob Liefeld had gone back and forth, because Rob Liefeld tweeted a cover. I think it was a What If that Liefeld did the cover for. Was it like a What If Cable had something something? I don't fucking know. So he had tweeted it, and Daryl retweeted it saying, hey, I have that comic. So I retweeted to Daryl and Rob Liefeld saying, it is on my fucking bucket list to interview Rob Liefeld about basketball and Daryl Morey about comic books all in the same room. And Daryl responded, said, sounds fun. I know, because I said that I can picture that Daryl as a kid would use analytic fucking code to assign value to his shitty comic books before he went out and traded them with other kids. So he says, as far as the podcast goes, it sounds fun. I didn't trade comics as a kid, just read them and put them in boxes that still take up a small warehouse to hold, which I thought was pretty funny. So for sure, I'm going to tweet them. I think Rob's coming down. What's the convention that he travels with?
Well, he was at Awesome last year, which to the best of my knowledge hasn't booked this year in Houston. But Comic Palooza is here this year, and he hasn't committed to that yet. We'll just have to see what happens.
It's the other one that he does. Is it the old like Wizard shows or whatever that go around?
Does he do Wizard? Well, Wizard doesn't come to Houston. Wizard goes to Austin, Dallas, and I think San Antonio.
Anyway, whatever that convention circuit is, I think they are coming to Houston again this year, because I want to say that he's mentioned it. But anyway, so around the time he comes to you. Oh, so anyway, yeah, somehow Rob has been very complimentary of the Houston Rockets lately over the last few months. And I know I've seen he and Daryl go back and forth a few times. So I don't know what Daryl has done to hypnotize Rob Liefeld, the Laker fan, into becoming a semi Houston Rockets fan. But it's very impressive. But I'm definitely going to hit them up with some tweets around the time Rob comes to town and see if we can even just get a couple snippets of quotes out of him. That'd be kind of cool.
Indeed, except that I only know who one of those guys is. And that's why I'm so glad to have you here to read the comment. Because I tried to knock some of these out a few weeks ago, and I'm like, yeah, I got to leave that one for Matt, because I don't know what the hell's going on there.
He's the general manager of the Houston Rockets, man. It's fucking... Anyway, go.
Well, I mean, I understand that. I understand what that means, but it doesn't resonate in by being any of it.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine.
I'm an anti-sports fan, as you're well aware.
Yeah, it's a damn shame.
Yeah, Count Druncula tweeted, can I admit I go into every episode hoping for a Rocky IV tangent? Referencing.
That makes two of us.
I think we're going to do a spring special for the ladies. And I think that whole like 30 minutes of excised material from the Black Widow podcast will just get thrown into there.
Or we do a Rolled Spine episode on Rocky IV. I think it'd be good, because we'd probably talk about Rocky IV for about 5 minutes, and then you and I would fight. I mean, you would just hear like microphones rustling and curse words, and probably fix it laughing.
Yeah, kind of like that.
Our next comic.
Fagin is all like, what happened? Andrew wrote, my interest in the Widow portion is 10 out of 10. Dynamo 2. Will you be covering some champions time? Whatever Drago hits, he destroys.
And Rocky IV.
Yeah, the problem is that the champions are not available on Marvel Unlimited, and I'm not forking over any of my dimes for that. So, no, that won't happen. But we will have more Black Widow, and fairly soon, in fact.
Yeah. We sort of had to get the Black Widow origin out of the way, even as we were reading it and doing that podcast. And I think it comes through in the recording, because I think we actually say it. It was really just us trying to get it out of the way, because that was one of the shittiest origins for a character that is now so popular they're starring in billion-dollar movies as could possibly be. Until Ant-Man comes in and trumps her, probably. Take that, Ant-Man.
Hey, at least his name's on one of them.
All right. Well, you know, there's still time. Our next comment's from Eternal Rage. Did you even mention Alejandra as Ghost Rider? It was a solid story. Figured it would at least be mentioned by Frank. Come on. Not even over-sexualized. It was hampered by a constant whiny, woe-is-me characterization.
Alejandra had put tits on a skeleton. I don't understand that. Ghost Rider, I don't know. It's like, I know that it sucks that you have that default status of male, but when you suddenly have tits on a skeleton, it just like, my brain just sort of goes, huh? What? Why? It just didn't make sense to me. And I never followed that story arc. I forgot that the Alejandra Ghost Rider existed. So, yeah, sorry. I never read it. I do like Matthew Clark as an artist.
Weird. When was that? When was this female Ghost
Rider?
That
was during the Fear Itself event. And I think she had a run of 10 issues or so. There are certain characters you can feminize and certain characters that doesn't work. And I just don't see Ghost Rider as a girl, because you have to acknowledge flesh. And it's already a shaky conceit that Ghost Rider can run around in an outfit and look bulky, even though he's supposed to be a skeleton with fire. So once you throw in anatomically correct genital, you know, like sexual identifiers, it destroys the whole suspension of disbelief for me.
Word. Okay. I can see how it would constantly be on your mind as you read a comic book. Every time they showed the character, you're like, how?
Yeah.
Our next comment's from Luke Dobb. I know virtually nothing about Alpha Flight. This should be a good listen. Good laughs were had throughout the Alpha Flight episode. Great Shag guest appearance. ! It was very amusing, that podcast.
Actually, I do like the country of Canada, though, so I feel bad about ragging on their hero teams. But that doesn't mean I'm going to read any Alpha Flight comics ever again.
Yeah, probably not.
Cal Drunkard wrote of the excellent Alpha Flight extravaganza. Okay, the audio in the first couple of minutes when Frank talked to Mr. Fix-It was so bad I was wondering why he kept it in the show. Then when Frank did the faux Siskoid answering machine message, I worried that the show was overproduced. But by the time he started calling Shag with a rotary phone sound effect, I gotta say I was laughing out loud. Yeah, literally LOLing, LLOL.
Sorry, literally laughing out loud, LLOL. I made me LLOLL.
Most of my exposure to Alpha Flight was in their occasional appearances in X-Men books. I enjoyed Stephen T. Siegel's run on Uncanny X-Men in the mid-late 90s. So when I saw he was working on an Alpha Flight series, that was the closest I ever came to diving into the characters. I didn't, though, because they're always seemed to be something better on my radar. To date, I've only read the first two issues of the original run by Byrne, and those were within the last year on Marvel Unlimited. A lot of the characters seem interesting, but the story couldn't grab me. You can put me squarely in the camp that considers John Byrne an extremely overrated writer. His Fantastic Four was solid, but not fantastic. His Namor was good, not great. I haven't read all of his Superman work, but I found Man of Steel to be simply okay. I have a short stack of She-Hulk on my desk that I need to get to. Good episode. I was sifting through 2 hours of audio with Shag from our last talk when I listened to this. And for a moment, I forgot what I was listening to.
Yeah, I could see how that would be a bit confusing.
I've been there.
It's happened to us sometimes, too, where you're replaying to check our levels as you're not talking, but then I'm hearing you ask a question and I'm wanting to reply to it. And then I realize then I reply to it because it's the recording of myself replying to a recording of you. It can really bleed together. It gets really, really bizarre.
Right, I don't actually have any comments to add to that because we've already talked out Alpha Flight as much as we possibly could.
Yeah.
Except I just have to agree, John Byrne, definitely owed over overrated writer. And you know, the Superman stuff doesn't hold up that great. And in fact, my favorite John Byrne She-Hulk story was in an issue of Fantastic Four. Once he spun her off into her own series and he tried specifically to do a humor comic, he showed that he shouldn't be doing humor comics.
You know what's interesting? So, you know Armor Wars, right? Armor Wars 2 was written by John Byrne, and that was actually the first arc of his run on Iron Man. Like, he started with Armor Wars.
I didn't realize that was him. I thought the guys had come back, the Leighton and the Michelinie had come back for that.
No. That was John Byrne. So
how was Armor Wars 2?
I can't remember.
that's a condemnation into itself.
Not really. I just, honestly, I don't even think I have, because I don't think it's collected in the trade for Armor Wars. I'm not even sure if I have the complete run of Armor Wars 2, honest with you.
I mentioned that I picked up those Marvel Ages, and I made a point of grabbing ones that related to Armor Wars 1 and 2. And even the editorial material promoting Armor Wars 2 wasn't nearly as interesting as the first one, at which point I don't even think they were calling it Armor Wars. I think they were just saying it's the new direction of Iron Man. So yeah, and the John Romita drew it, which would be the main draw for me, is I wouldn't mind seeing the Romita artwork, but it didn't look nearly as interesting, and I don't know what the premise was.
Well, and it's the scratchy John Romita, not Bob Layton John Romita. John Romita Jr.'s run with Bob Layton was absolutely the exact opposite of his run on, say, Thor, right? Like, it's not even the same artist. But yeah, so you still had John Romita Jr., so he was coming back to Shellhead, but you had Byrne writing it. So I'd kind of be curious, since everybody keeps saying Byrne's shit doesn't hold up. I think Eric Larson and Rob Liefeld were going off on Twitter about John Byrne the other day. So I think they were saying the same thing too, that none of that shit holds up. If you don't go back and reread his old stuff, it's not any good and everything. So I'd be kind of curious to read Armor Wars 2 and see kind of how it is. But I would read it before I pushed it off on you guys. And we would definitely need to do Armor Wars 1 before Armor Wars 2. So
yeah,
anyway, well, that just got me thinking about John Byrne. Our next comment is from CJ. He says, another great episode with Black Widow origins. So is Paquita the Black Widow of the mighty Rolled Spine? I think that she would take great exception to that.
Yeah, most likely.
Our next comment is from Eternal Rage. He says, Red Rocket versus Crimson Dynamo, quote, pretty ass awful, quote, end quote, dash Frank.
Yeah, I don't appreciate Rocket Red coming into the conversation. It's like, you know, I'm a JLA guy, and I'm familiar with most of the Rocket Reds. It was an interesting story arc that originated in Green Lantern Corps when Steve Englehart was playing out the ramifications of having an entire team of alien lanterns operating on Earth. One of them, Kilowog, decides that he somewhat allies with Soviet Russia and helps them to create their own force of armored soldiers to protect themselves, since America had all those superheroes. And one of them ended up becoming a couple of them ended up becoming members of the Justice League. And they were usually comedic characters. They usually came in for levity because everybody knew they were cheesy armored Ruskies playing out stereotypes. So for them to be treated like real characters when I don't see them that way, I just see them as devices, as a medium for the comedy, bothers me. And I like them as social commentary. I like them as comedy. I don't like when you actually gave a name to any of those individual ones, because I don't see them as characters, honestly. I dehumanize them, to be honest with you. Where Crimson Dynamo is one of the main Iron Man villains. The Rocket Reds are clearly very derivative of all those different Soviet era Iron Man villains. It's like trying to bring Deadpool into conversations about Deathstroke. Irritates me. I don't even want to talk to you after you do that.
Whoa. I can see that. I honestly, I have no knowledge of Rocket Red at all. When was Rocket Red? When was he created?
Mid-80s. Mid to late 80s.
Oh, okay. So not even close to...
I wasn't sure
if he was one of those bizarro DC characters where I find out he was created like in 1939 or
right.
something.
Right. Or the whole like Doom Patrol X-Men thing where they were somewhat synchronized almost. So you're not sure if one ripped off the other or if there was just something in the water.
So, but no, mid-80s. That's... sorry, dude. Anyway, so our next comment's from Siskoid. He says, Radio Shack will endure. It's the Alpha and Omega. It was around before the universe was born, and it will survive to the next. Radio Shack is Galactus. And then he says, well, it looks like you guys jinxed Radio Shack. They filed for bankruptcy. I never had a thought one way or the other about Black Widow until very recently, really. I liked her last couple series, and I do like ScarJo in the role, even if I didn't see it in Iron Man 2. So I'm like pretty much everyone on this. Bring on Scarlet Witch to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Once we get more diversity there, heroine-wise, it'll draw more attention away from the fact that Marvel's only female hero needs to use her beauty, which is somewhat retrograde and sexist trope, I agree. Thor's a little like that too, though, so let's not judge too harshly.
There's much truth in that.
Yeah, Thor is nothing but cheesecake movies, basically, for chicks, right?
Well, it's like the three of us, the only people in our circle that want to see the Thor movies are the girls, because they either want to see Thor with his shirt off or they want to see Tom Hiddleston. So, or Loki, I should say. So, yeah.
Yeah, for real. And that dude, again, that dude has always got his shirt off. Good looking dude, man.
And lovely hair. Lovely hair. As far as the Radio Shack thing goes, I don't know if y'all caught the one of the most recent episodes of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., depending on when this broadcast. They reference that as a Hydra base. Radio Shacks are Hydra bases.
But again, Radio Shack will endure. They're going through bankruptcy. They're going to close a bunch of locations, but they're just going to grab a foothold, man. I'm telling you, it's all fake. It's coming back. Radio Shack is not gone.
Hey, you know, Marvel went through bankruptcy too.
Yeah, exactly. Like Jeff Goldblum said, something finds a way. I don't know, whatever the hell it was, from Jurassic Park.
It was 25 years ago. Fuck it.
That might not have been the line exactly. something.
It's not a particularly good reading either.
Look, a Radio Shack is going to fall into some sap on a tree and be cloned in the future. in the theme park that people will go visit.
And then spit venom in Wayne Knight's face?
Yeah, it right in fucking Newman's face. All right. Okay, our next comment's from Ange. He says, "Isn't interesting show mixing in the cartoons and comics? I knew little about this early stuff. Most of my early exposure to Black Widow was in the Marvel team-up and Champions. Later, it was in Daredevil and Captain America. I've tried her solo series and minis, but they've never quite grabbed me. I completely agree with you that ScarJo pulls off the character well in the scenes, where it appears like she is being played, but in fact playing the guy. The scene with Loki and Avengers where he's unwittingly is giving her information while she feigns concern for Hawkeye is brilliant." Agreed, agreed, agreed.
Okay, Count Drunkly wrote, "First question, who or what is Alpha Flight? I think my first exposure to Black Widow was on an Impel Marvel superhero trading card in the early 90s. I always knew she was part of the Avengers and Daredevil's history, but I cannot remember the first time I noticed her in the comics. She always just there. The Black Widow miniseries by Devin Grayson and Greg Rucka was pretty good, but I don't remember anything about it now, so maybe that's a knock on its quality. The current series by Nathan Edmondson is really good, and Phil Noto's art is gorgeous. My thoughts about ScarJo and Black Widow in the films mirror just about everyone else's. I thought the actress was miscast in Iron Man 2, but she has steadily gotten better with each appearance. Mostly my problem with her in Iron Man 2 was that the character was unnecessary. You could have removed Natasha from the film and the story wouldn't have suffered. It might have even been tighter. And if she was going to be infiltrating Stark Industries in the film, she should have been presented as the villain, as an actual foreign or corporate spy working with Vanko. Solid argument."
Yeah. I like Iron Man 2. Everyone shut up.
Yeah, me too. And you know, ultimately, I enjoy the movie better now for having enjoyed Black Widow in later movies and projecting that affection backwards through time to Iron Man 2.
Whoa.
Plus, it was really cool when she maced that dude.
Yeah. All okay. Right, next comment's from Quantum... What is this?
Guatam Shaorin, I think.
Guatam Shaorin on number 32, Marvel Universe Live. "Hey, guys. Great podcast. I was listening to this episode, and I wanted to give my two bits on the format. I like the episodes where you do a deep dive on specific Marvel characters. I love getting the back history on the characters and the stories of the creators. I find it as fascinating as the stories themselves. I liked your Shadowland episode as well. I had never read the series, but I had always been interested in it. I was disappointed to hear that it was mostly a train wreck. Still, that world you described is pretty interesting. In the hands of a skilled writer, I could see some good stories that could come out of it. I'm curious to see how it plays out in Secret Wars." Yeah, I think we all agree with that, right?
Yeah, yeah. And also, I'll point out that among those Marvel Age magazines I picked up, there is an annual where they have a 3-to-5-page short story that lays out the Shadowline universe way better than the Dr. Zero book did. Wrote, of Marvel Universe Lives, "Just listening to this after a week of vacation, a couple of pointers. Number one, the Fantastic Four teaser. I think my concern about the teaser is that it felt a bit like the Superman movie history. When Superman Returns, a touchy-feely movie, seemed to fail, I think Warner decided to go the complete opposite direction. And so we get Man of Steel. The truth is somewhere between these extremes in the right Superman movie. After the goofy, cartoony, simple prior Fantastic Four movies, I wonder if the movie makers decided again to go in the complete opposite direction. And so this trailer seems so serious, so dark, so real. Somewhere in the middle is the right Fantastic Four movie. Like Frank, if I didn't know it was a Fantastic Four movie, I would have thought the preview was for a Prometheus type of film. Two, Uber Batman in his costume. I don't know if the earlier Black Panther would have anything to do with the Uber Batman. All that has to be born from Frank Miller's Dark Knight. That fight scene in DKR has been dissected here. Like Frank, I think that Superman could have ended in seconds but was holding back. Instead, most everyone talks about how Batman now could defeat everyone. I don't buy it either. I miss the world's greatest detective, not this omnipotent paranoid guy in a bat suit. As for big ears, infinite cape, and blue, I'll bring up two people. One, Marshall Rogers, in his short run on Batman, had a very big cape, and Todd McFarlane in the year two also had a big cape. I know, shocker. Thanks again for a great show."
Yeah, the Marshall Rogers link, that's a nice looking Batman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Englehart and Rogers on Batman is one of the classic runs that they've actually revisited it several times in the years since because people regard it so fondly.
Yeah. And this McFarlane image that he linked is awesome, too. Let me see. What's the rest of his comment? Yeah. I guess we've talked about the Fantastic Four movie. I think he tends to agree with you more, obviously, here. Yeah, that's about it. I think we're going to find out when this Fantastic movie comes out if it's good or not good.
Well, let's see a trailer first. We're still on teaser territory.
Yeah, we're still in teaser territory.
We don't know what any of these guys look like. We don't know what Doctor Doom looks like. People keep saying that they think that they're going to the negative zone and battling Annihilus. We haven't seen any of that either. Not enough there to really get too deep into. Not that that ever stopped us.
All right, next comment's from CJ on episode number 32, Marvel Universe Live. "Hey there, guys. Awesome work by Fixit in the first half of episode number 32. Max's awesome work was in the second half. High praise for Frank's knowledge of the comic universe, and that includes his knowledge of anything beyond the fourth wall, which is very impressive. That being said, when it comes to comics, Frank and Fix are the ones I take their word the most because they seem to have a better working knowledge. As for movies, I have to go with Maxim because he is so far removed from the current comic world that he's more reasonable with his thoughts on the superhero movie genre. Frank's extensive knowledge of comic book universe makes him way too hard on the movies. I can understand being hard on movies, but Frank takes it to another level entirely. Nothing worse than hearing someone, quote unquote, in the know of the comic universe telling a casual fan who enjoys and likely only knows in a Marvel movie universe that the movie they just watched and enjoying is dog shit because, yeah.
Insert rant. Yeah, we need to insert the rant here. Yes.
The reason episodes like The Black Panther and Patsy Walk episodes are so good, in my opinion, is that Mac and / or Fix It take a genuine interest in the topic. This makes for good information and good conversation for long time friends. There doesn't need to be heated debates for shows to be good, just good conversation. When Mac and or Fix It don't seem interested in the subject, I think the episodes suffer. As good as Frank's knowledge is, he still needs someone to play off of to make it click. I don't think that it matters that the casual superhero movie fan doesn't have a pre-existing knowledge of, for this example, the Fantastic Four. If the casual fan decides to see Fantastic Four no matter how, they will either go in blind, which seems even fanboys are trying to do now, or call friends that know some history on the characters, or just do what a lot of people do and search on the World Wide Web. So what? That those that know, and those that don't know. I think it's starting to sound like not knowing might be the better way. Oh yeah, one last thing. Yeah, Mac is probably the villain, but only because he's very dismissive of anything he doesn't have knowledge of. Would these gems by Mac make for good shirts? Don't know, don't care, and I'm right, you're wrong. Oh, this is a big comment. So I want to start at the top, because he gives props to Fix It for his first half of episode number 32. Mr. Fix It can tell a damn good story. I think we've heard many of Fix It stories through the years, and whenever he gets going on a story, it usually turns out pretty good.
Yeah, one of our main issues with the podcast, this one specifically, is it's so structured, and Fix It doesn't work well with structure. Fix It smash.
Yeah, fix it smash. Fix It tell you. Well, and it's the same way in our Rolled Spine podcast when he's telling his story about his close encounter, no pun intended, with Leonard Nimoy. No. It's easy to get into his stories. But yeah, he does a good job.
It's hard to boil Fix It down into the podcast because, especially this one, that's got a fairly rigid format. And he's a guy who can jump from subject to subject to subject. You can hear more of that on the Rolled Spine podcast, where he's just like, okay, I'm going to go and talk about this for a little bit. So that's, I think, a better distillation of Fix It than we can get here.
Yeah, he's very much Mr. Fix It, but at times can be the Savage Hulk. And just smash, as you said. What else is in this that I wanted to talk about? I think he's right. I think a lot of people are trying to go in blind now. I think people, and we've talked about this before, there's two active groups. There are the people who want as many spoilers as possible, right? And then you have the people who are in the know, but are actively avoiding spoilers. And I just think I think they're just two animals of people. I think that it can work the other way for you too, where you may hear it because you're not trying to actively avoid spoilers on Fantastic Four because you don't care. So it's possible you could be exposed to a spoiler that could pique your interest and be like, you know what? I kind of want to see how that's going to play out. No? Possibly?
Yeah, no. I can see that. Sure.
Okay.
I mean, because again, if Annihilus turned up in that would definitely be a spoiler, but I have much more interest in seeing Annihilus in the Negative Zone than in another goddamn Doctor Doom movie, because that guy has not played well in cinema so far, and it's a damn shame because he's a cool-ass character. He should be every bit as cool as Darth Vader, and if not cooler, but that sure as hell hasn't happened yet.
No, that is... You are correct. Dr. Doom is so badass, and they just keep fucking him up, man. Let me see. Yes, you should make t-shirts about me just in general. That's all I got on that.
The Marvel Superheroes podcast is in no way affiliated with or endorsed by Marvel Entertainment. All characters mentioned and audio clips employed are believed covered under fair use, with no infringement intended against their copyright holders. The views expressed in this podcast are assumed legitimate, truthful, and solely possessed by the speaker.
Hey, all right.
Is that the name of the one with the weak chin, the comedian?
The one with the weak chin. God damn. God help the sketch artist, too, if you ever robbed and have to describe...